Okay, talking about the problems of inequality, one of the things that we're seeing now is a movement to obviously to increase the minimum wage, and California has gone to $15. New York, I think, is in the process of going in that direction over the next 5 years. This is a question: would a $15 national minimum wage be beneficial or damaging for the middle class, specifically for small business owners? That's a leading question.
I mean, I've seen studies on both sides. I mean, and I think Alan Krueger did a study at Princeton on the effects of the minimum wage and found virtually no impact on business, and there are a variety of other studies that have suggested it's retarded growth at the low end of the job-paying spectrum and has done much to prompt McDonald's and others to create kiosks that people can order from directly without the intervention of a human being. So I'm not sure that we have definitive work on it from an economic perspective, and I think it depends really industry by industry who's going to be affected the most. And so I suspect Mitch is going to...
good on the evidence. Let's just say, it's not my area of economics, but my read of what the studies show is overall employment effects pretty modest. That might be because only about 5% of workers are at the minimum wage kind of levels. So if you look for impacts, the detected impacts are largest for very narrowly targeted groups like low-skill, disadvantaged youth. You'll see some employment effects, but the overall negative employment effects, there's not a lot of evidence. But likewise, there's not a lot of evidence that the raising the minimum wage does a whole lot to the overall income distribution. And I should say, all of the experiments that we have evidence on are not really about raising the minimum wage to $15. That's far, there are 5 to 8 states that's higher than the median wage in the state. So we've never done something like that. Most economists prefer the earned income tax credit to raising that to raising the minimum wage because it has no disincentives for employment. That is, it's basically like a subsidy to, if you earn some money at work, then we supplement that you earned with subsidy in the tax code, which has the strong advantage that you don't end up, something like 20% of minimum wage workers are not low income households at all. They're like the teenage kids of houses who have higher income. And the earned income tax credit doesn't have that problem. So I think on the evidence, there's still basically a question mark. We don't really know what it would do.
Anybody who doesn't think this has a negative effect on employment never spent 10 minutes in a small business. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, even for larger enterprises, but certainly for smaller enterprises, the money's got to come from somewhere. Most of them can't pass it on. They can't jack up the cost to their customers, so they will find ways to reduce the exposure. And that means fewer people hired. That probably weighs more heavily on younger people. That's too darn bad when that happens. And particularly in a time when automation is moving fast, this is the best favor. If I was building robots of some kind, this would be one of the best favors that somebody could do.
Along those lines, we talked a little bit about this today. What are the jobs of the future for our young people? And I guess, I'll just add, obviously we're into a period where we're talking robotics, we're talking artificial intelligence, we're talking about all kinds of technological developments taking place that basically are going to probably cut jobs as opposed to developing jobs. So where do young people, where are the future jobs for young people?
Well, I think technology remains quite interesting, and coding is an enormous skill for young people to develop, and I think they do it somewhat naturally given their exposure to the technologies that they see. As we discussed earlier, I'm a proud owner of 3 millennials, and they come to this technology quite naturally, and I have an 18-year-old who can send, I believe, or has sent over the last 4 years, 160,000 Snapchats, which is averaging 100 a day. Tongue right, tongue left, duck face, those are the three poses for the Snapchats. The kids got that better earlier in the day, by the way.
That brought the house down.
But I think also, you know, there's an interesting futurist who works at CCNY, Michio Kaku, who is trying to complete Albert Einstein's unified field theory. And he's a very interesting futurist. And he gave a presentation not too long ago, and she showed what medicine is going to look like in the future, with doctors who are actually operating on a sheet of glass that is a complete outline of the patient's body, internal organs, nervous system, and it's all done with their finger guiding a robotic laser arm in the operating room.
So it's going to be like a live voodoo doll.
It's going to be a live voodoo doll. Exactly right. This is with much more precise pins. But everything that's technologically oriented and disruptive offers, I think, the opportunity for young people to take advantage of that. I think even some traditional media might still be good. There's an interesting thing that was an item that was just pointed out the other day. Of all the advertising dollars that have gone into social media, Facebook and Google, I believe, have aggregated something in the neighborhood of 85% between them. And what we're seeing is that social media entities are migrating to television. So television and other forms of traditional media are actually still an interesting opportunity. Communications as a broad category remains quite interesting because there's so much now where these technologies are merging, and particularly the young people who are so fluent in it will have, as we did, let's say, with cable TV when I was growing up, opportunities that are brand new.
So,
let's keep going. That's fine.
What is and is not working with regards to trade agreements with other countries, including China? Let me just broaden that to talk about trade agreements in general. Republicans, Democrats used to support trade agreements. Now Republicans, Democrats are condemning trade agreements as losing jobs in this country. What is the story with regards to trade agreements?
I mean, as I started before with the premise, 75% of the U.S. economy has nothing to do with international trade. Our services are things that the economists call non-traded goods. And that's what I was going to add to the discussion about what are the jobs of the future. One of the biggest trends of what Americans spend their money on, we spend less and less share of our budget on actual stuff, and we spend more and more on services. Because as the price of cars goes down because of productivity, you don't buy two cars, you still buy the one car, you just pay less for the car, you know, as a share of your income. Or likewise, TVs and stuff like that.
What kind of car do you drive?
I have a very old car, but
so right. Wait. The better question,
I thought you must, because you haven't bought a car lately.
The better question is, what kind of car do you drive?
He doesn't just drive
2005
the car
Taurus. I mean, sorry, Avalon, Toyota.
As you look at that shift, that tells you a bit about. That indicates as well, what are U.S. exports? What is trade? How does trade affect the U.S.? We were talking at dinner. The U.S. exports, we're by far the largest, world's largest exporter of services. And we're especially good at exporting things where if you come here from another country, that counts as an export in the data. So when they come to the restaurant, from tourists from China come to the U.S., that counts as export. If they come to take class at Stanford, that counts as export. We exported more educations than steel, than computers, than I guess one of the biggest exports of the United States. And the things that have mostly worked with trade agreements are totally the opposite of what the saying NAFTA's the worst and the TPP is bad. I kind of don't understand. It makes me sad that we've developed a bipartisan consensus against trade, because if you actually go look at NAFTA, NAFTA cut tariffs on U.S. exports to Mexico by far more than it cut anything coming to the U.S.
Austin, correct me if this is wrong, but I believe that we have a positive balance of trade to the countries under a current
trade agreement.
I think that's true. That varies, depends on, you know, what happens to the price of oil, yeah, but
right,
yes,
but
I think
our negative balance of trade is not coming from the, it's not in our
so
exchanges
I think,
with
I
the
think
country.
This I think we misdiagnosed the problem, but B, the thing that has needed addressing in trade agreements and in globalization generally has been the rise of China. When China first got into things, they were basically a very poor country. And we, our system treats developing countries with lighter gloves than it does established economies. And so in a way, there are a bunch of things China was able to get in under the wire so that it received a bunch of favorable treatments. And now it's a giant economy, bigger than Japan, you know, approaching as big as the U.S. And that we have to change that. And in particular, they have a lot of national champions, not tariffs, but supporting their own industries and using non-tariff barriers to block foreign investment, things like that.
Just like Japan did in the 80s.
And it's like Japan did, and ironically, the TPP is actually pretty good at that. It's the first trade agreement that tries to address a bunch of non-tariff barriers in a direct way, confront restrictions on foreign investment, confront the national champions. But it's just being lumped in with everything else, oh, NAFTA and the TPP and all that, and that's what's ruined this country. And so, I don't know.
Chances are, Ron, what do you think the chances are we'll get a trade agreement?
Zero. Absolutely. The one thing I would say, you know, not before November. I don't think there's any reason for anybody to give a victory to either side. I think what would be interesting, we've had this relatively artificial ban on crude oil exports for the last 40 years. If and when the United States begins to fully export crude oil, not just crude products, and liquefied natural gas, we will go from a trade deficit, which is now less than 2.5% of GDP, to a trade surplus in about one day. And if and when we do that, this whole argument will be moot because we'll be running trade surpluses and we'll even finance our budget deficits differently as a consequence.
Yeah,
and it's really one or two smart moves to make that happen.
Lots of talk right now about the so-called Panama Papers. How relevant, Panama Papers are the, they exposed the situation where people were basically putting their money into companies in Panama and getting the tax benefit of that. How relevant are these offshore accounts, and what can be realistically done with them?
Well, first,
they're legal.
Ron, were you mentioned?
I was not mentioned. Okay. No, I run most of my stuff through the Caymans. So.
Look, I would say there's the specifics on this, and then there's the broader issue. The specifics on this, you've seen some people, including Bernie Sanders, says, "See, I told you the Panama Free Trade Agreement was going to be a nightmare," and that's a frustrating argument because that's the opposite of correct. The deals with Panama open transparency with the Panamanian authorities, and that's why in the Panama Papers there's hardly any Americans. It's precisely because we signed that deal, not that there are none, not that there are many. But the broader issue of tax avoidance, perfectly legal tax avoidance, whereby companies are engaged in a process of getting an unbelievable share of the total world profits of corporations, are now being quote unquote earned in these tax havens that have 0.05% of the world's population. It's something like a quarter or a third of all corporate profits are actually earned in Vanuatu. And so I used to make fun of do you think they're really doing this activity in Tuvalu? And I kept saying Tuvalu, but it turns out I maligned poor Tuvalu. It turns out Tuvalu is not a tax haven, and the highest point in the country is 18 inches above sea level. And they have no industry, and they're about to be removed as a nation. And they're like, why are you picking on us? So I think that issue, that very low actual taxes paid and that it's all going to these tax havens is an explosive issue. It's not just in the US, you see it in Europe. There's a real uprising in the entire OECD, and you're going to see more action on that front.
Okay. Four largest banks at the time of the 2008 recession controlled a third of the banking assets in the U.S. at the time. Today, these same banks control 40% of the overall assets. How can this be allowed to happen?
Well, who made them do it? First is the first question. During the crisis, the U.S. government asked J.P. Morgan, whether it was politely or impolitely, to acquire the assets of Bear Stearns for a certain dollar amount per share. It started at 2 and ended at 10 for less than 100% of the company. Then Bank of America was asked to acquire Merrill Lynch, Wachovia, and Countrywide in order to rescue those firms. So this was part of a government operation in the midst of the crisis to rescue the very failed institutions that we did subsequently bailed out, and now we're talking about separating them again. I think with Dodd-Frank, which already, from my perspective, has some punitive impacts on the bank and is not allowing low interest rates to be transmitted to the people who need them the most, the least of our problems right now is pulling the banks back apart. They're better capitalized and less levered than they were during the prior to the crisis. They're comparatively, when you look at the rest of the world, in extraordinary shape compared to European banks, which haven't even begun to write off their 2008 problems, let alone their sovereign debt problems. The one thing I would do is pull Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs out of the Bank Holding Company Act. And if they're going to be an investment bank, let them be an investment bank, and then they can live and die on their own. I think the banks themselves, over time, Bank of America may want to get rid of Merrill, but it was the U.S. government that asked them to take it. So it seems kind of strange, from my perspective, for the government to be unwinding the very stuff that they foisted upon these institutions.
I don't know how to unwind it, but it is not a healthy situation. And I think, frankly, at least in some quarters, it's a conscious strategy to convert the banks into yet another government utility. So the government can allocate capital and push it around. It's how we got in the crisis in the first place was the government forcing, Austin it was, I sat on bank boards and loans were made in huge quantities and insured at Fannie and Freddie and so forth. And that's the danger always. It's one of the reasons you might have this hard landing you talked about in China. Because the government.
I'm not disputing. Look, you'll never find economists who are willing to defend the business model of Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah.
And all of the things that you raise were issues. I object only to the statements of exclusivity that this is the thing that caused the crisis. There are a lot of things that caused the crisis. There was that one year when the Detroit Lions went 0-16. They're the only NFL team to ever go 0-16. And in that year.
Well, Tampa Bay went 0-14 just because it was a shorter season.
Yeah, but 0-16. Yeah. They're the only ones. And I guess in that year they had a really crummy kicker. And the kicker cost them several games. Okay, but you can't blame that they went 0-16 all on the kicker. And I kind of think that, look, in each of these cases, there were things wrong, but there were many things wrong besides just that.
Okay, fair enough. My point is that when government direct lending can definitely
be problems.
Mm-hmm. Look, let's just get it out. It was the Bush administration's fault. They did it all.
Let's just stop now.
End it right there.
The role of the non-bank financial institutions was critical in the crisis. When the people complained about the Community Reinvestment Act, which required banks to lend into low-income neighborhoods, that's a rule that only applied to banks. But two-thirds of the subprime lending was made by non-banks. And the Community Reinvestment Act did not even apply to them. And we tried to do some things about the shadow banking system in Dodd-Frank, but with limited success. The one thing they did is they said, okay, well, at least if you're big enough, you will have a regulator, and that regulator will be the Fed. But now they got this court case about MetLife, where the judge said, no, the government's not allowed to declare MetLife to be
just under regulated.
So that's really kind of an existential threat to Dodd-Frank. I think we're going to have to see how that plays
out. Let me ask this question. We just talked a little bit about the Fed. Is our economy too dependent on the Federal Reserve? And did it make a mistake in raising interest rates?
Mitch, what do you think?
I think it made a mistake in driving interest rates down to a historically unprecedented level and holding them there for years. And I don't know when and how we get out of this box. You want to talk about trickle-down policy. This is the best example I can think of. It's not just the effect, it's the intent of that policy was to run up the price of commodities and stocks in the hope that people would feel richer and rich people would spend more money and so forth. And it hasn't worked. And, we're in what people are calling quantitative exhaustion stage. And so I'll defer to these folks about the pace and timing and nuances at which we try to get ourselves out of this corner, but I don't think anybody believes we just want to stay there indefinitely.
No, I don't think anybody wants to stay there indefinitely. 80% of world monetary policy is now at zero or lower. 23 countries in the world have negative interest rates, which includes the European Central Bank, encompassing the continent, Northern European countries, Japan. The U.S., and I would probably disagree with the motivation behind the move to zero, was in part to create a wealth effect, but it was also to allow banks and corporations and households and the government to recapitalize after a balance sheet crisis took us into a situation where many, many institutions, both public and private, were insolvent. And the only way out of this particular crisis, which was the largest since the Great Depression, was to do extraordinary things. Otherwise, from my perspective, we would have gone into another Great Depression. Now, the exit strategy is very tricky insofar as the Fed is trying to pull out as everyone else is lowering rates. And it's creating huge strains in foreign exchange markets and global markets, generally speaking. The faster the Fed pulls out, and the more Japan goes into negative territory, the more strains we create in emerging markets, the more currency disruptions, commodity disruptions we have, and we raise the risk, I think, of going into another financial crisis. So I think the pace and timing has to be extraordinarily careful and extraordinarily slow, and most crises like these take at least 10 years to exit.
I would say my answer to that question is, on part A, I think I agree with Governor Daniels that we have been too dependent on the Fed. I mean, I think we have. I don't think it was a mistake for the Fed to do what they did. And I guess I think of it as, what's the counterfactual? It is true that the Fed's policy has penalized savings, has increased the asset values of a bunch of assets. A lot of assets, of all assets, are owned by wealthy people. So as those returns went up, they have done better. The question is, what if the Fed had not done this? What if the Fed had just kept rates at 4% through this crisis? In my opinion, obviously, it would be dramatically, horribly worse for the middle class and for non-rich people. If we had had, I think we could have had a Great Depression, even if we had just had an twice as long and even deeper recession, it would have been worse. And so it's that we kind of got to, that's the proper comparison. We're often stuck in the situation, we're doing things we never wanted to do and we never would rationalize just because every other thing is so much worse. So we're like, well, I guess this is what we're going to do here.
Can I just ask Mitch a question? If the Fed were to precipitously raise rates and let's say slow
part of the question. Precipitously and dangerously.
You mean like the time track they're on?
Yes. If the Fed made a tragic and fatal error in policy. Yeah. But had the Fed not lowered rates, one could argue that the bond market would have done it anyway because the economy would have been just that much weaker. Yeah. And we might have seen a 0% 10-year yield as opposed to a 0% short-term rate, no?
Well, yeah. But we are, I don't know where you want to date the trough, we were 6 years. How many, how slow enough for you, Ron?
I personally think they shouldn't do anything until the rest of the world's normal.
So I actually think they made a mistake in raising too early.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Let's go to education. You have said that a knowledge-based economy is critical to job growth and a healthy economy. That said, the cost of higher education is skyrocketing, which can discourage young people into seeking higher education. What can be done to make college more affordable? Mitch?
Purdue University, we froze tuition in 2013. It's still at that level. This is the third year. Next year will be the same level again. And we're looking at at least one year beyond that. We decided that we would hold that variable constant and see if we couldn't adapt our spending to the budgets of our students and their families, as opposed to require them to adjust their budgets to our preferred spending level. So far, so good. You know, the students that I salute about 3 weeks from now as they graduate will be the first of at least three straight classes to go through Purdue University and never experience a tuition increase. By the way, we also lowered the cost of food by 10% over that time frame and the cost of textbooks through a deal we made with Amazon. So when the federal officials calculate the all-in cost of attendance, it's cheaper in nominal dollars to go to our school today than it was in 2013. So the starting point is, I believe, before we talk about ways of financing and all the rest, although we must, the starting point ought to be a real soul-searching on the part of higher education. Why are you charging all this in the first place? And what have you done to clean up your own house? And there's a whole lot that can be done. And then I'll pass the baton, but I want to tell you, however, we gave the biggest pay raises in our peer group last year. The salary pool went up 3.5% at Purdue University, and we're making major investments in our College of Engineering, in our Computer Science Department, in our former College of Technology, in the very areas at which we believe we excel. That will contribute to the knowledge economy that we're talking about. You know, as concerned as I am about the future of young people, I'm not particularly concerned about the Boilermakers. They're getting jobs at almost 100% rate, and they're going to have great lives. I'm much more worried about the rest of the people in their age cohort who may not have those same opportunities.
Let me ask this, and we're getting close to the end here. How important is rebuilding our infrastructure and the impact it could have on the economy? Austin?
I would say, if done properly, quite important. As you know, the long history of infrastructure spending in the U.S. is of varied economic quality, if we were going to evaluate it on those grounds. And the bridges to nowhere, highways to nothing, that's an infrastructure spending that it has some direct impact in that some people will have a job for 1 year while they do it, but what you want are things that are, from my perspective, what you want are things that are pieces of infrastructure that will raise the productivity of everyone else. That if we build a better backbone for the broadband, it will attract more broadband using companies to use it. Some of the achievements of the highway system of the U.S. were in raising the productivity, and that we could put plants at different parts of the country and we could ship the stuff in a reasonable and cost-effective way. We've always had low taxes and low government spending, so we have always had worse infrastructure than European countries, for example. But I think the differential's gotten so extreme now that it's actually hurting us. Not only is it not giving us the positive contribution we need, it's hurting us. No. That, in Long Beach, the bridges are so beat up that the port of Long Beach, the truck drivers don't want to take the bridge. They drive all the way around. Yeah. So that they don't.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end. We've talked about a lot of important issues, but I think ultimately These issues rest with you, the people, and the voters in terms of deciding what the future of this country is going to be. And I hope you will take that into consideration, because that's the key to a greater economy. Thank you very much.